The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Excuse me, I've got a long speech to make first. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket this morning. In the order of their presentation, they are PPG Industries Incorporated versus JMB Houston Centers Partners Limited Partnership from Harris County and the 14th Appellate Judicial District. Southern Union Company and Others versus the City of Edinburgh from Hidalgo County and the 13th Appellate Judicial District. NP Inc. versus Gerald A. Turboff, Trustee, and Julius Glickman from Harris County and the 8th Judicial Appellate District. In each of these matters, the court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will complete the arguments of each of these cases before lunch, but we will take a brief recess in between each presentation. Justice Jefferson is not sitting in PPG versus JMB Houston Centers. We welcome to the proceedings today Mr. Steve Smith, who will shortly be joining the court as our newest justice and will participate in the decision in these cases. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in PPG Industries versus JMB Houston Centers.
May I please the court? Good morning. This morning I would like to discuss two issues. First, that the treble damages should be reversed and rendered because JMB has no right to recover under the DTPA. And second, that the actual damages should be reversed and rendered because JMB's causes of action are barred by limitations as a matter of law. Let me turn first to the DTPA issues.
So it's not your argument that the whole, that all of DTPA is punitive and therefore doesn't survive. It's just the treble damage part.
No, we believe that all of it is punitive and shouldn't and doesn't survive. I think that if you do any other kind of analysis, although, you know, I can give you authority on why you could do that kind of piecemeal analysis. But I think if you do any other kind of analysis, it is a piecemeal analysis, and it doesn't comport with the purposes of the statute.
But to go that way, we would have to find the whole purpose of the DTPA is punitive, and it has no remedial aspect, right?
No, I think that the way that the courts have looked at it, and let me give you the argument how you can do a piecemeal interpretation. The Dearborn Stove case was a case in which there was a Rent Control Act, and the argument was that the landlord had overcharged in the rent. The statute provided for a penalty of treble damages and attorney's fees. The tenant assigned his right to his company, the company that he worked for. The company sought to enforce the treble damages. The court, this court, said in 1951, well, that's punitive. And that penalty is a personal right that doesn't survive, so it's not assignable. So you can't get your treble damages. However, the court did say in that case that they could get their actual damages.
Well, I thought you were going to tell me the support for your argument to throw the whole thing out.
The reason that I think that with the DTPA that doesn't work is because the DTPA is a separate cause of action. If you throw out the punitive damages and the attorney's fees, you're left with a cause of action that's duplicative of the cause of action for breach of warranty. The court in Maryland versus Head addressed...
In this particular case, you're saying?
Well, yeah, I think...
Because I mean, that it, well, what, all the laundry list is nothing?
Well, the laundry list is certainly something, but it's duplicative of other causes of action that could be brought.
That wasn't the way it was sold.
I'm sorry?
It wasn't sold that way back in my day.
Let me ask you to make sure I understand what your position is on. Do you agree there was assignment of a cause of action for a pre-existing breach, not just the assignment of the warranty?
Under their theory, yes.
Do you agree with that? I mean, I couldn't. It looked like in the breach you were just sort of assuming that there was an assignment not just of the building and the warranties that went with the building, but the pre-existing DTPA claim.
Yeah, we argued below that that wasn't the case. We argued that it wasn't the case because in the contract itself, the contract that transfers the property from HCC to GMB, the contract says the DTPA doesn't apply to this in any way, and apply to this transaction in any way. And we cited cases that said you have to have an express assignment of cause of action. And because there was no express assignment, they didn't transfer the DTPA.
But you didn't make the argument here?
No, we made the argument in the Court of Appeals, and it was held against us, and we wanted to focus the court on the assignability. The assignability of the cause of action in this case depends on whether it's survivable. And it's not survivable because it was a personal punitive right that died with the person. The Dearborn Stove case says that. The Hackworth case says that. Now, the case that they use, of course, is the Tomes case. And the Tomes case was a case in which the court held that it should survive. Now, I attached to the brief a copy of a law review article in which the author has gone through a lengthy analysis comparing and contrasting all the cases. What he says about the Tomes case is that the Tomes case was a case where they were trying to stretch and shape the law in order to reach a certain result. If you look at the policy behind the DTPA, the policy is one to create a remedy that will be able to punish the wrongdoer. And Tomes was trying to find a way to protect the consumer. Now, there are a number of policy reasons why assignment is not good in this case. Let me go through them.
I'm not at all sure the DTPA was designed to punish the wrongdoer. I thought the DTPA was to provide a cause of action in consumer transactions where the amount in controversy may not be really enough to encourage the consumer to exercise their rights they couldn't afford to. And one of the elements used to create this the economic incentive to bring the claim was to treble the damages. It had a punitive aspect, but it really had an aspect that was to encourage consumers to vindicate their interests in court and to make the money worthwhile to prosecute.
It's certainly one way of looking at it. And
so if that's the trend of the DTPA, why wouldn't that be consistent with assignability of DTPA claims? Because the whole purpose of it was to encourage a lawsuit. And so why should we not permit assignments in those circumstances? Because we're supposed to encourage lawsuits.
Well, the purpose of the DTPA was to protect the consumer. JMB is not a consumer. By their own admission, they have more than $25 million in assets, and they could never be a consumer.
But that's changes in the statute as the legislature started tweaking the statute to try and make it more closely focused on what they were attempting to do. But when this ostensibly the cost of action arose, you're talking about a DTPA that didn't have that limitation on the wealth of the consumer.
If I may respond, the author of the law review article tries to make the connection between remedial, which is what you're talking about, remedial purposes and punitive purposes. And the test that he gives for remedial, and I think it's a workable test, is remedial is when there is providing compensation for the loss. Punitive, on the other hand, is when the wrongdoer is forced to pay more than the loss, money in excess of the loss. That has, according to the analysis of the cases that have discussed personal punitive rights and whether they can be assigned, that is how the courts have held. When you have to pay more than the loss, that's a punitive requirement. Now, the way he described it, because we certainly acknowledge that there are many purposes in the DTPA, but he talked about it as being punitive with a remedial aspect. And the Hackworth Court not only cited the Dearborn case, but looked to some of this court's own cases. The Birchfield case, for example, looked at whether an exemplary damage remedy and a punitive and a DTPA treble damage remedy were consistent. And they said no, because that's a double recovery of punitive damages. they focused on the damages as being punitive. This court also addressed a similar situation in the Stewart Title versus Sterling case.
Let's assume the damages are punitive, and the rationale is that that's a private cause of action, and so we don't allow that to transfer. If we say that DTPA actions are not transferable or not assignable, is that not inconsistent with the stated purpose of the DTPA, which is to encourage lawsuits?
Well, I don't think the DTPA was to encourage lawsuits, it was to protect the consumer. And an assignee is not a consumer. An assignee is not the one that had the dealings with the defendant. An assignee is a stranger to the judgment. The purpose of the DTPA was certainly not to protect strangers or to create a windfall recovery for them of treble damages. Now,
but are you arguing that this DTPA claim is not assignable, or any DTPA claim is not assignable?
Any DTPA claim is not assignable.
Do you know if a fraud claim is assignable?
Fraud claim is assignable.
Why isn't you get punitive damages for fraud? How does that fit your argument?
The fraud claim is, first of all, not a statutorily created penalty. Fraud claim is a common law cause of action that the courts have survived.
Then let's take a Sherman Act claim. It's a statutory claim that provides for trebling damages. Is innocent.
I don't know the answer to that.
I think it is. Assume that it is. How would that fit?
The way that the courts do it is they first look to whether the statute has a survival provision, whether it has a survival section.
And Sherman Act does not.
The Sherman Act, of course, would be based on federal case law, and I don't know what the federal case law is with regard to the Sherman Act. I know what the Texas case law is with regard to these kind of personal punitive causes of action. Going all the way back to Johnson versus Rolls in 1904 and going to the Dearborn Stowe case in 1951, this court has never allowed a personal punitive cause of action, one that allows the consumer to get a penalty to either survive or be assigned.
It seems to me there's a difference between a punitive damage claim where the fact finder is going to set the amount of the damages and a mandatory penalty claim like the insurance code with the 12% penalty or whatever it is, and this old statute that had a mandatory treble. Is there anything to that if the penalty is mandatory, it's more likely assignable than if it's not mandatory?
Right. I don't think either one works. And the reason I don't think so is because this court in the Haynes and Berman versus Bowser case said that you must compare, you must conduct a Moriel review of any DTPA additional damages. That would be the mandatory treble or the additional damages. You have to do a Moriel review with the Krauss factors. Now, how would that work with an assignee? One of the first Krauss factors is compare the sensibilities of the parties. Who are you going to compare? Are you going to compare the little old lady, or are you going to compare the Fortune 500 company to whom the cause of action was assigned?
But I don't think the statute, it's trebled as a matter of law, right, or doubled or whatever it comes out.
Correct, but it still has to be considered to be appropriate under a Moriel case, an a Moriel type of analysis.
You're saying that in Haynes and Boone, we did away with the automatic treble damages of the 1973 DTPA?
No. Haynes and Boone, the court said that you must conduct a Moriel review of DTPA additional damages,
which is something a jury awards in its discretion.
Correct.
Why don't you move to your limitations argument?
All right. The starting point for limitations is, of course, KPMG beat Marlowe. The reason that that's a starting point is because that's in that case, the 1999 case, this court talked about when the limitations begins for a DTPA claim. The court said that the limitations begins when you know or should have known of the wrongfully caused injury. Now, in that case, the plaintiff contended, well, it shouldn't begin until I know of all the separate wrongful acts that caused my injury. And the court rejected that.
What about when you buy a car and when you buy it the first year, the water pump goes out, and the the warranty is met, the dealer meets the warranty. 6 months later, the water pump goes out again, the dealer meets the warranty, and just beyond the warranty, the water pump again fails. Does that, how would you characterize that? When you've got things that go wrong with the car, either the same thing or different things?
Fortunately, we have a long line of authority dealing with that very issue in construction defect cases. In construction defects cases, it begins when you first know that you have a serious problem. When you have a serious, for example, it doesn't. When you've read your first leak, it's not a problem. When you have multiple leaks in the house, it's a problem. That's the tenant insurance. When you have a problem with a few feet of pipe in your sewer system, that's not a problem. When you have 60 feet of pipe in your sewer system, that's a problem. The courts have looked at these kind of cases, and there's a long line of authority, none of which was cited by the Court of Appeals, which say that once you have a serious problem, then you're under a duty to investigate. In this case, over 3,000 of the 12,000 windows, undisputed, were replaced. It's also undisputed that PPG told them when they left that project, after replacing 3,000 of the 12,000 windows, that...
Well, let me ask you a question. What about the argument that each piece of glass had a separate warranty limit?
I think that
warranty was breached as that glass would
go. I think that's a red herring. Let me tell you why. The cite that they give for that proposition is the record, volume 14106. The question that was asked in that cite was, does the warranty cover all the units? Yes, it does. But there's nothing in this record that says each individual unit had an individual warranty. And it's not consistent with their theory either. Their theory is that all of these glass panels were inherently defective and that the breach occurred when these were installed in the building. For all of them. That all of them are defective when they were installed in the building back in 1977. And therefore, this separate warranty idea doesn't work with their argument.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please the court? Mr. Bruce Golden will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I'm Bruce Golden along with Eileen Levy. I represent the respondent, J&B Regional Center. This is not a construction defect case. This is a case that involves the sale of separate, individually warranted goods. Your Honor, that was not an argument that was made. That's what PPG stated throughout the trial proceedings. There's no controversy about that. And there's also no controversy that there were no defects involved in the construction of the curtain wall, the constructed part of the wall into which these individual units were placed. Nor, PPG said, is there any issue about the installation process or the glazing. This case does not involve construction defects. It involves the sale of goods. It involves claims under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act and the Uniform Commercial Code. Each of these units, which PPG has described as a complex product, which PPG invented, which was new at the time it was sold to Houston Center, each of these units is installed one at a time. They're replaced one at a time. And the testimony from PPG was that you expect to have failures in a high-rise building. You may have a lot of failures from time to time, and that is absolutely not an indicator that you have an overall problem or will have problems in the future. Now, perhaps because these units are replaced one at a time and they're large, they're 10 feet tall, it takes a long time to pull out a window and replace it, perhaps that explains why PPG has erroneously indicated to the court that none of these units have been replaced. In fact, a replacement project to replace every single one of these units has been ongoing for some time. It will continue for some time, just as the replacement effort in 1983 to 1985 took a long time, involving much fewer number of units. There's no dispute about this not being a construction defect case.
You agree the breach occurred in 76.
The legal breach did, Your Honor, but under the Uniform Commercial Code, Section 7725, a cause of action did not arise or accrue until the owner knew or should have discovered the breach. And similarly, under the DTPA, there's a discovery rule. And here, Your Honor, there's no question the parties agreed that for limitations purposes, any claims that were discovered timely claims were claims that were discovered on or after September 25, 1989. PPG admitted in the trial court that limitations began to run on the DTPA claims on October 13, 1989. In their second motion for summary judgment filed just 2 months before trial started, they said, and I quote, it's at page 40 of our brief, there is no disputed issue of material fact that J&B was notified by PPG on October 13, 1989, that PPG was not going to replace any additional window units in One Houston Center because the 10-year warranty had expired. Therefore, the period of limitations commenced on October 13, 1989. At that time, J&B knew the condition of the window units and also that PPG was not going to replace any more units in One Houston Center.
Can you make a binding legal concession on a statement in a motion for summary judgment?
I believe under this court's authority in Holy Cross versus Wolf that there is authority for that, Your Honor. I believe that constitutes a judicial admission, case decided last year by this court. This was not a momentary position, by the way. This was a considered position of PPG in the jury instructions, which they concurred in the statement of law to the jury. They said that a breach of warranty and warranty submission by agreement applied to both the DTPA claims and the UCC claims. It was considered a correct statement of law for both by stipulation of the parties. But PPG said that a discovery of the breach could not occur until both, this is the language, both there was discovery of a defect and PPG refused to honor its warranty. Again, that occurred for the first time on October 13, 1989, after the September 25, 89 date that established the bar date. So, and that's actually is perfectly consistent with their argument in the trial court, where they were relying on the fact that they hadn't breached the warrant, that they had done what they were supposed to do. They were still contending that the products weren't defective, that the warranty didn't cover them. They lost those issues. So now on appeal, they've reversed position on that. But the fact of the matter is that according to the law of the case, as established in the Sargent case, 1953 decision of this court, and of course Rule 274, they can't change that approach on appeal. And that conclusively establishes that these actions were timely. But of course there's more. PPG argues on the one hand that a question of notice should have been submitted to the jury, but at page 23 of their reply brief they note that the purpose of notice in a warranty case is to give the seller an opportunity to cure, to investigate, determine if there's a defect, and then have an opportunity to cure. PPG, in this case, misrepresented that they had cured, not through repair efforts. The kind of cases that construction defect repair efforts that PPG relies on, but through the replacement of these goods. There were substitute goods supplied, and PPG assured the owner of One Houston Center that all of the problems were corrected with the replacement effort that occurred between 1983 and 1985. And although PPG points to some early guesswork about the extent of the problem, in a face-to-face meeting in June of 1983, PPG, and that's Plaintiff's Exhibit 74, PPG made it clear, Gene Greaves, a 48-year veteran of PPG, who was the head of their warranty division and the corporate representative for PPG throughout the trial, he made it clear that this problem would be corrected with the replacement of discrete units. And that was based on PPG, the inventor of this product, having taken six or so units from the building, subjected them to extensive laboratory testing at PPG's headquarters, and reporting back that the problem could be solved. Now, that statement was false because we knew from discovery that at the same time that Mr. Grieve was making those statements, those misrepresentations, he knew because the lab had informed him that the seals were attacking the coating, that all the units were inherently defective, and that because of the aspect ratio of these units, PPG did not have the ability to manufacture units that would not fail. And that was true not just with respect to the units that were originally sold, it was true with respect to the replacement goods that PPG was representing they were putting into the building to cure the problem.
Let's go back to your original argument. You started by saying that every time these units fail, there's a breach. And so that each time a unit fails, there's a breach of warranty. Is that your position?
Well, actually, there was a breach at the time of delivery and under the DTCA and the UCC, because under the UCC, breach occurs at the time of delivery, even though the cause of action is approved when it's discovered. And under the DTPA, PPG misrepresented the characteristics of the warranty and misrepresented that
the
goods were not
protected. I'm just trying to put this all together here. I don't understand. The first thing you said when you got up here was, it's not a sale, it's not a constructive defect case, it sales separate units.
Correct.
And that's still your position.
Yes.
So when a unit breaks today, or once your client purchased the building, is that a separate violation of the DTPA every time one fails?
I think you could certainly view the case that way, Your Honor. In the shatterproof glass case, a case out of the Eighth Circuit in Missouri, noted that because units are individually warranted and defects with respect to some doesn't indicate necessarily defects with respect to others, you could find that in 1991 there were separate breaches of warranty when there was this explosion of failed units at the building.
If that's true, why doesn't the provision of the DTPA saying that your client's the amount of assets that you have prevents you from suing under the DTPA, why doesn't that
Because as discovery revealed here, at the time of this sale, there was a breach of warranty with respect to all of the units. It doesn't mean that at later times when they fail, that wouldn't give rise to another claim purely for breach of warranty under the Uniform Commercial Code. But under the DTPA, Your Honor, and under the code as well, breaches occurred at that time because the units were defective and the warranty was not being honored. They could not replace the units with non-defective units, as PPG admitted in August of 1996 through discovery in this case.
The dates I'm a little bit confused about. There's an argument about when the cause of action began to accrue. Just my normal thinking of things, if I had a four-year warranty on an automobile, and so they were continuing to honor the warranty to try and repair a particular problem that I had, and then finally the warranty period expires, and then they announce to me they're not going to repair the car anymore, even though the defect continues, I would have ordinarily thought my statute of limitations would run from the time that they refused to honor the warranty. Do you agree with Mr. Holman that the statute runs from the time that I knew I had a problem with the car?
No, and that's not the law of the case as submitted to the jury either. And in this situation, Your Honor, what actually happened was, the analogy would be, you go in with a problem with your car, and they say, Justice Enoch, we're so sorry, here's a new car. That should take care of the problem. That's what happened here. These goods were replaced, but they were replaced with equally defective goods. Now, at the same time that...
Assuming that's the case, when do you claim the statute of limitations began to run in your case?
It could not have run any earlier than October 13th of 1989, because that's the first date that PPG said that it was not going to honor the warranty any longer.
Now, you've described the UCC and the DTPA as having a common discovery rule. Is that the discovery rule you're talking about, that you could not have discovered the injury that you suffered until they said they weren't going to honor the warranty, or is that the date the statute begins to run as a matter of law? You understand my question? Is that a discovery issue, or is that when the breach occurred?
Well, for purposes of this case, they're the same. The law has been established by the instructions to the jury that discovery could not occur until both the defect was discovered and they refused to honor the warranty. Under the Sargent case, Rule 274, that is the law of this case. But, Your Honor, with respect to your question, if J&B or Houston Center had attempted to bring a lawsuit any time before PPG said it was not going to honor the warranty, it would have been thrown out as frivolous. There would have been no, based on the representations, which were, we've honored the warranty, we've replaced your goods, and we wouldn't be able to show any damages at that point. So the earliest time that we could have begun to discover any issue was in October of 1989, again, within the limitations period.
Let me ask you this. If the damages had been trebled in this case under discretionary trebling, rather than the version of the Act that was in effect at the time that it was applied, would you agree that then the additional damages would have a punitive nature that would not survive?
I would certainly agree that an aspect of multiple damages under the DTPA is punitive. But that's just one aspect. And they would still survive because the DTPA is a remedial statute that's to be liberally construed, a concept that this court acknowledged just 2 weeks ago in Miller versus Kaiser.
But for an express warranty case, what does it add except additional damages?
It supports the purpose of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, Your Honor.
But I mean, you say it's a remedial statute, but the only thing it adds is additional damages.
It adds, consistent with the legislative mandate, the remedies that the legislature thought important in order to encourage lawsuits, to deter similar violations, to promote an efficient and effective means of protecting transactions like this.
Well, if your argument was this statute creates a cause of action for actual damages and also has a punitive element to it, and you have to take them both together, so the punitive element doesn't just cancel out the remedial part of the statute, then I see the argument has some force to it. But the cause of action for breach of warranty was there before, and all the statute adds is the punitive element. So if that's the case, why should that action, as opposed to the warranty action, we all agree the warranty action would be the same, but why does that mean that, why should the statutory action be the same?
Well, I guess simple answer, Your Honor, is because the legislature has said that breaches of warranty are also causes of action under the DTPA, but of course we had jury findings with respect to both an unconscionable contract as well as the so-called laundry list DTPA violations.
Why isn't the unconscionable cause of action under the DTPA very intensely personal? I mean, it does focus on the taking advantage of a specific person.
Well, I suppose in a sense it could be viewed that way, but here I can't imagine an action being more impersonal. This court has said for 120 years that property causes of action or actions related to property are assignable. It is classically impersonal, and that's true with the unconscionability aspect as well. A gross disparity between the value received and the consideration paid and at the time of the transaction.
But there's also the element of taking advantage person to a grossly unfair degree. And why, I mean, a plaintiff who was very savvy, very sophisticated, might not win an unconscionability cause of action for that reason, because the jury just felt like he knew what he was doing, even though they might find for him on the warranty claim or some other claim. And vice versa, someone who didn't really know what they were doing and was really trying to operate in good faith, might win an unconscionability cause of action. Why isn't that the kind of personal thing that shouldn't be decided?
Well, of course, we have a jury finding in this case that there was unconscionable conduct. And, Your Honor, I think that's what decides the case. That's the governor, if you will, to make sure that of what kind of claims you actually have. But here, there is no question but that at the time of this transaction, PPG understood it was subject to the mandatory trebling and the other aspects of a DTPA action. As this court observed in Gupta, it makes no difference to the original seller whether there's been an intervening owner. The harm is just as great to the subsequent owner who purchases the property, and the responsibility, you know, greater with respect to the seller. And that's the situation we have here.
But as I take your argument, you have a broader argument, which is they could have assigned, the predecessor, prior owner, could have assigned this claim to the ABC Claims Purchasing Company just as well as they could assign it to you. And that's your argument. Any claim under the DTPA could be assigned to anybody.
Well, actually, that's not my argument, Your Honor. I think that this case should be decided on these facts. And here, you don't have a situation, as Justice Holmes described, of a situation of fact from which the claim sprung being separate. Here, this claim followed the property, and it literally followed the property. This claim wasn't even known at the time that this transfer of property occurred.
But it did follow the property into the hands of someone who, on their own, would not be able to bring a DTPA claim.
Well, but as of 1976, they certainly would have been, which is the date that I think we need to look at. If this assignment had not occurred, then Houston Center Corporation surely would have been making the same arguments, asserting the same position, seeking the same damages, and PPG would have been defending on the same bases and making the same arguments that it is here.
Isn't it a little incongruous to say, well, I have to get the 1976 law for a claim where limitations didn't start running until 1989?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor, particularly in a case where there was such evidence of fraudulent concealment here. The opposite the result would be, if this claim were not permitted, then PPG or any seller could simply fraudulently misrepresent the characteristics of their goods, deceive the purchaser, and be satisfied that at some point in time, if I've done that successfully long enough, I'll be able to argue that the DTPA claim no longer exists.
That was one of my concerns. It seemed to me that you were kind of mixing up the discovery rule with fraudulent concealment. And as we know, they're different things and there are different burdens on that. And you did not get a finding with regard to limitations on fraudulent concealment.
Well, obviously, they are separate concepts, of course, Your Honor. And here, with respect to fraudulent concealment, PPG should be equitably stopped to be asserting limitations as a defense, given the abundant evidence of misrepresentations that they made.
Mr. Coleman, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it would make it if this court concluded that when you're talking about a breach of warranty, the cause of action does not accrue until that point that the warranty is avoided by the seller. If they tell you we're not going to honor the warranty, your cause of action for breach of the warranty could arise at that point.
If the court
concluded that what really is going on here is that there was an effort to be replacing the windows, and at some point they decide we're not replacing any more windows, and you're suing for a breach of warranty to have good functioning windows, that the cause of action would accrue at the time they breached it, which would be 89.
That's when the discovery occurred, Your Honor.
But if the court determines that's when the breach occurred, then you'd be under the 89 statute as opposed to the 76 statute.
Well, to do that, Your Honor, respectfully, you'd have to avoid the jury answers to questions 1 and 2, and also you would end up upsetting a great deal of law with respect to when a claim when a breach occurs versus when a cause of action accrues, even under the Uniform Commercial Code.
I agree with PPG that this is really the issue is when you discover it as a matter of law.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
When you discover it as a matter of law the defects in the glass panes.
Well, it's actually an intensely fact-bound question, as this court has held. Both the discovery rule and fraudulent concealment are intensely fact-bound, and here there was obviously more than a scintilla of evidence that the owner of One Houston Center didn't discover and within reasonable diligence should not have discovered before then. And KPMG doesn't change that result at all. There you had a plaintiff who actually sued a defendant. He understood he had an injury. He had a wrong. He sued a defendant. He just didn't sue everybody. That's not our case here. We have no quarrel with KPMG, and certainly fraudulent concealment pleadings in a summary judgment context would not rescue a claim, but that's not our situation.
Here, let me ask one more question, trying to understand where you come from. If this action arose today, could JMB take this assignment, being that it's worth more than $25 million?
Certainly they could take the assignment, Your Honor. Now, that's a situation different. Here, there was no known claim at the time they took the assignment.
Let's get rid of all these parties and all these facts. Is there any impediment to the assignment of a DTPA claim to someone, to a new claimant that has more than $25 million in assets under today's law?
Well, it would depend on when the transaction
occurred. If it arises today, the breach happens today and the lawsuit is brought tomorrow, And the assignment is day after tomorrow.
If it were a property damage claim with the cause of action being transferred along with the problem, the property, then I believe the assignment could occur. Now, it'd be a much tougher question and an issue about the treble damage aspect, but under this court's teaching in Hoffer and Lavender, then there's nothing particularly offensive about the survivability of a claim for punitive damages. But that's not the situation we have here, but in reference, if I might, with respect to that, counsel cites this law review article by Matthew Rawlinson, a student comment. It's my understanding he was a summer associate at PPG's trial counsel's firm at that time, at the time he was writing this, but at the time of this trial. And unfortunately, my copy of that article doesn't include the conclusion page, next to last page of that article. But Mr. Rawlinson even says that with respect, he advocates a situation where a DTPA claim should be assignable, but says that the multiple damage aspect should not be.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
When did the breach occur? That is the big question here. The only way
but
that
didn't
they
the jury instruction define that, and it was unobjected to?
The jury instruction was unobjected to, but we're talking about whether there's any evidence that they didn't that limitations didn't run as a matter of law. The reason that the jury instruction was unobjected to is because the court had already denied both an instructed verdict on this issue and a directed verdict on this issue. And so we preserved, under the Arrow Energy case, we preserved the no evidence challenge to the limitations.
So you're bringing a no evidence challenge to the jury's finding, and you're saying there's no evidence to support their finding?
Correct.
Under the instruction that the first time they knew the warranty would not be performed was the October date?
We're saying that limitations is established as a matter of law, and that there's no evidence to support the findings that it wasn't. The reason that this is an issue is because the only reason that they contend that the 1973 stat DTPA applies is because they contend the breach occurred then. If the breach occurred when they found out about it in 1989, they would be barred from bringing the DTPA action.
Well, I'm confused. The breach could have occurred, but there's a discovery rule in DTPA. And the jury was asked a question about the discovery rule specifically. And they were instructed that PPG's failure to comply with the warranty could have occurred until it refused to perform its obligations under the warranty. So there is evidence that as of October 13, 1989, that's when PPG refused to perform the warranty. How did you get around that?
Their contention is that we didn't perform on the warranty when it was installed, because we installed all defective things that they say we knew were defective. That's when they say the breach occurred. There's a case called Lambert versus...
But again, the question is, even if that's the case, the discovery rule applies here. And how do you get around this jury instruction on the... Are you saying the discovery rule does not apply here?
No, I'm saying the discovery rule applies, but the evidence is undisputed when they had knowledge of the injury. And that it's not the knowledge of the injury that...
Well, but the definition says the injury and the refusal to correct it.
Well, we have in the Lambert versus Wandsworth case, which is an express warranty case, the discovery rule runs from the time that you know of the injury. In that case, there were 10 different times that he tried to get the contractor to repair it.
That gets back to my question on the way it was defined here as the injury and refusal to perform. And there was no objection made to that definition. So how do you compare it to the case you've decided?
Well, I think in that case you're talking about defects in the charge. In this case, we're talking about what evidence supports the charge.
But that's the point.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing.
We have to take the charges given and look at the evidence to support that. And I see your point goes to the A part of the charge, that when did they know of the injury?
Right.
But there's a B part to the charge that says, and PPG refused to perform its obligations.
Well, under their theory, of course, PPG refused to perform its obligations when it replaced 3,000 of the 12,000, didn't replace all of them. At the time that PPG left...
I thought there was a stipulation as to the October date.
It's not a stipulation. That's also is a red herring. In That is brought up in the second motion for partial summary judgment. It was brought up at a time when we were still trying to argue that the two-year limitations apply. It was an alternative pleading. This court has often held that in order to be a judicial admission, it has to be clear, positive, unequivocal, and that if you make statements in an alternative pleading, that's not a judicial admission. We preserved our limitations point both in the instructed verdict, which is in the record of volume 16, page 142, and also volume 20, page 5, where we preserved our limitations arguments in instructed verdicts. We also preserved our limitations arguments after trial and post-verdict motion.
Let me ask it this way. When do you say that the evidence conclusively established that PPG refused to perform its obligations under the warranty?
Under their theory.
When do you say that we can say as a matter of law on this date PPG had refused to perform its obligations under the warranty, and therefore there's no evidence to support this jury's finding?
I would say that occurred in 1985. PPG finished doing all of the repairs that at the time. The 3,000 out of 12,000 windows, and they said to Dennis Greer missed this in the record, that there's no way to predict whether any more are going to fail. In other words, they admitted that there was a problem that they had no control over,
but they couldn't repair. But they didn't say also, and if there's another problem, we're not going to fix it. This is it. Did they?
No, they didn't say that. Let me make one point about fraudulent concealment, because if you have notice of the injury, fraudulent concealment doesn't apply. Fraudulent concealment ends when you have notice of the injury. And all under their theory.
When do you say that we can say as a matter of law on this date PPG has refused performance obligations under the warranty, and therefore there's no evidence to support this jury's finding?
I would say that occurred in 1985. PPG finished doing all of the repairs that at the time, the 3,000 out of 12,000 windows, and they said to Dennis Greer missed this in the record, that there's no way to predict whether any more are going to fail. In other words, they admitted that there was a problem that they had no control over,
but they couldn't repair. But they didn't say also, and if there's another problem, we're not going to fix it, this is it, did they?
No, they didn't say that, Let me make one point about fraudulent concealment, because if you have notice of the injury, fraudulent concealment doesn't apply. Fraudulent concealment ends when you have notice of the injury. And all of this about PPG fraudulently concealing things, because they had notice of the injury and they had noticed that the defect was not cured, then they could not pursue this cause of action.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.